Well, today I have the pleasure of talking with Gretchen Baskerville, author of The Life-Saving Divorce. Gretchen's work helps partners take the next step after getting clarity from doing the kind of work that redemption from biblical battering provides. Her Facebook group provides support from others going through the challenges of thinking about or actually separating, divorcing, and into the recovery. I am so pleased she has helped so many women and men who have struggled with the confusion around divorcing within your faith beliefs. Welcome, Gretchen.
Thank you so much, Shirley. It's great to be with you.
You've been facilitating divorce recovery groups for over 20 years now. How did you get started in that?
Well, about 25 years ago, when I was a young mother in my early 30s, I had just gone through a life-saving divorce from a man with immoral and illegal behavior. And I was trying to raise my little children alone. I was exhausted. I was overwhelmed. And due to my husband's illegal behavior, I ended up with sole custody, which I was happy about that. But I felt lonely. I felt like I had this black cloud over my head. I thought I'd never be happy again. I felt that my life was over. And that my children, due to getting a divorce, you know, would just turn out to be emotional basket cases and juvenile delinquents. And so I divorced to find relief from my husband's behavior. And I did find that. I mean, it was just good. It was a huge sigh of relief to get away from him and to feel like we were safe. But I had no hope for a happy future. And boy, was I wrong. You know, God had bigger plans for me than I ever dreamed. And about 2 years into my divorce, our church was looking for, they wanted to start some new small groups, and they wanted some women's small groups. And there was another single mom in my Sunday school class, and we looked across the room at each other, and we were like, yeah, we need a small group for single mothers in this church. Now, it was a mega church, so we had a, you know, there was a good chance that we had a lot of single mothers. And so we ran that group for the next 6 years without a break, week after week after week, meeting with single mothers, the vast majority of whom were divorced and really struggling to make sense of it all. So that's how I got started.
Well, it sounds like you really do understand where recently separated or struggling believers are coming from.
Absolutely.
That's so great that you had that opportunity. Your breakthrough book, The Life-Saving Divorce, was published in 2020 and began your Facebook group the same year. Now, how has that added to what you understood before from doing the recovery work?
Wow, it's added a lot. And I'll tell you why. You know, when you've done this for 20 years, you start to get a little cocky, right? You start to think, well, I know it all. You know, I've seen everything. I actually used to say, Shirley, you're going to really laugh. I used to say, there's nothing you can tell me about your marriage or about your divorce that I haven't seen before. Oh, no, even after 20 years. I still see things that I've never seen before. Wow. My husband, so I was single for 20 years after, so that means I remarried in my mid-50s, and that was just 4 years ago. And my husband said, my new husband said, you know, you've really got to interview a lot of people because not everybody is a California Christian. Some people, you know, you need to interview people from Texas, Florida, New York, the Midwest. You need people from Ohio and Nebraska, and you need people from Canada. You don't really know anything about anything unless you've really done a ton of interviews. And so that's what I did. And he was absolutely right. You know, I think that each person comes from a part of the country where they look at the issues a little bit differently. And that was phenomenal for me. So you asked me how it's been going. Well, The book was published last year, The Life-Saving Divorce. And the title alone gave people words for their own, you know, much needed divorces. Absolutely. It wasn't a frivolous divorce. Right. It was a life-saving
right.
divorce.
Yeah.
So just the title alone, I had no idea what a good title that was. But people were like instantly, okay, I get it. Now I can explain it to other people.
Absolutely.
You know, I wasn't a quitter. I got a life-saving divorce. Anyway, the book has more than 180 five-star reviews on Amazon, which also really surprised me.
Fabulous.
Thank you. And then I started a private Facebook group in 2020. It's called The Life-Saving Divorce for Separated and Divorced Christians. And that took off more than I expected. I started it, first half of 2020, and now it's got more than 2,500 women and men who needed life-saving divorces. So that, and so now I even learn more. You know, now when I throw out a question to my group, I learn things I didn't even learn while I was doing interviews. So the idea that, a pastor or a counselor who probably have seen fewer than 100 people in their whole professional career know everything there is to know about divorce is probably a little far-fetched, because I'm still learning. And this has been a big part of my life for over 20 years. And I run that Facebook group, as you probably well know, you're on Facebook a lot too, hours every day interacting with people and posting links and helping answer questions. So as I was writing the book, and then I did a second edition of my book, I learned a lot from these interviews and then from people on social media. So I've been the other thing that I've learned from doing this book is how much we as Christians are really, we don't ask a lot of questions. We're super trusting. And so when someone makes a claim about divorce and kids and what effect it will have on kids, or divorce and adults, and what effect and the level of happiness or lack of happiness you'll have. We never ask any questions about that. We never say, well, show me the source. Well, show me the study. Give me more evidence of that. Whoever said that? Who were the researchers who did that study? Was that a study of 10 people, or was it a study of 1,000 people? And we are pretty gullible. I mean, you know, we trust our churches and we trust our pastors so much that we're just incredibly gullible at anything that a Christian says. And the other thing I discovered in the last 2 or 3 years is that Christians have almost no correct information on the topic of divorce and what it does to kids, and divorce and what it does to adults. And when it comes to the past 30 years of research, the people who inform us and teach us, they omit really important facts and they distort a lot of the research findings, even when they do quote the actual researchers. So, you know, those are some of that was kind of one of the ugly things I learned while researching this book. But that kind of gives you an overview of, you know, what I've learned since it came out.
Well, that's fabulous, because with the social media now, it gets dispersed and opens the windows because, as you know, you feel like you're in a box. And not only do you not know how to get out, you don't think you have permission to get out.
Exactly.
And so the torment, you know, is very great. What I learned talking about studies, what I learned is that religious victims stay longer in abusive relationships. One study found that they stay 11.4 years versus 8.6 years. The abuse had continued for 9.4 years versus 7.4 years. In one Arizona county, 42% of the 600 abused residents attended weekly church services.
Oh, wow. So that weekly churchgoers. These aren't just in the marginal, you know, cultural Christians. They're putting in the time and effort to get up Sunday mornings and go. Wow.
600 shelter residents, 42% attend weekly church services. My workbook, Redemption from Biblical Battery, tries to remove the seven levels of confusion around religious domestic abuse for women, because victims in their home have so much shame, they don't come forward for help. And so it's very difficult to minister to men or women in this situation. Have you found any keys to reach the victims? Because your audience is one step further than my workbook. What I'm trying to do is get the person, the reader, to clarify for themselves, what do I need to do now that I've gotten rid of all these misconceptions and misinformation, and I've come out from under the manipulation and the deception and all the tactics that are used, and I start to see the light of God again. What do I need to do? So have you found any keys to reach the victims?
Well, like you said, your book is kind of the pathway that they need to start with, you know, coming to realize this is abuse and no, this isn't God's will for me and I don't deserve it. And, you know, my spouse's really dangerous marriage destroying sin. They like to blame it on me, but it's not really my fault. He stands before God alone. And so they need to go through a workbook like yours first. I always say, I use the fishing analogy, you catch them, Shirley, and I clean them. So, so, I mean, books like yours that describe examples of abuse and are very empathetic start to open people's minds and give them permission to break through the shame these victims feel. And I really understand shame. I stayed in shame even after my divorce, I think until, 2012. So 9 years ago. So I had already been divorced, 15 years before I really broke through the shame. And that was an amazing year for me. And you know, in your book, you ask your readers about God. Is God that self-centered egotist like your spouse, or does he love you as a beloved daughter? Are you more valuable than a sparrow, or are you just worthless and disgusting? And then you offer divorce as a godly option, and that's what my book. That's where my book kind of takes it to the next level. We need to offer divorce as a godly option because it's really important. Many of them have never heard that in some cases, divorce, and I'm talking about life-saving divorces. We're not talking frivolous divorces. Life-saving divorces, it's very often the divorce is the best and most godly path to protect them and their children. So, and then books like mine, I know you have a lot of Bible verses in yours, but I really wanted to dig down. I've got 50 pages on the biblical basis for divorce, not only for infidelity and abandonment, but also for physical and emotional abuse and addictions. And it shows how the top researchers all agree that divorce is likely better for children if the home is toxic. So I've got a whole nother chapter on kids in divorce where, you know, you figure out how to rank your own home and the toxicity and the conflict in your home. And you determine whether or not it's likely that a divorce would be better for your kids or not. I'm not going to tell you that, but I will tell you what research has found. The other reason they stay is due to the messages they've gotten from their churches. And we all know that, especially that abuse is not a valid biblical reason for divorce. And I did a survey in my private group and found that nearly 8 in 10 believed that abuse was not grounds for divorce in God's eyes. And that's scary. That means that a lot of women and men in my group were being driven to despair and depression and suicide. And they've told me their stories. Many are afraid they'll be killed. Others are staying in a violent, demeaning situation because they are afraid that if they leave and have to share joint custody with their ex, that he will hurt the children, maybe even kill the children. And so we really have to look at the messages our church gives us and the lack of real access to research that we have as Christians have been given access to.
That is so important. You know, it isn't that long ago that a woman being assaulted in her home could not file charges against her husband. Right. It wasn't even classified as assault because it was within the home. And so this education that you're doing and that other advocates are doing, that I'm doing, is so important. And to have this platform that's so accessible and easily broadcast is so fabulous. So the facing these enormous challenges, what has been the bottom line that you've learned for most or many of the survivors? What was their bottom line in saying, I just right. can't do this anymore?
Right, right. What was the straw that What was the bottom line? What was the straw that broke the camel's back? What was that shattering event that finally woke them up? One thing I've learned from all my interviews and from running a group like this is that everyone is different. Each person has different circumstances. What got you out, what got me out, was different from what got other people out. So I identified in my book 10 different common turning point. I call them turning points. It's that moment when the light goes on and they finally get desperate enough to leave. Again, just for our listeners, these aren't, you know, greener grass divorces or I'm bored divorces. These aren't I miss the party life divorce or, you know, I'm really kind of disappointed that my husband doesn't do well divorce. These are divorces. These are divorces to find relief from a real toxic situation. And one day their eyes open and they accept reality that their spouse is too destructive. And if they stay, their life, their sanity, their reputation, their children, and their future will be destroyed too. So let me go through the top 10. I'm going to focus on the top five. Number one is going to be really surprising to anyone watching this who isn't familiar with the dynamics of abuse. And that is people wake up and realize, I'm not just in a painful marriage. I'm not just in a sad marriage. I'm not just in an unhappy marriage. This is actually abuse. There's a word for what's happening to me, and it's abuse. And a lot of times they don't realize this until they see a list of abusive practices, examples of abuse. So I've got one of these on my website, lifesavingdivorce.com/130 examples. And this wakes people up because, for example, a lot of people don't realize that when you have a spouse who wakes you up in the middle of the night for no good reason, that is sleep deprivation. And that's actually considered torture under the Geneva Convention. So that is a form of abuse. Number two, the second most voted for turning point in my poll was people left to protect their children from either having abuse directed at them or from seeing their mother or father being abused. So it's either direct or indirect abuse. When people, it's very common for abuse victims to say, you know, you can hit me, or you can criticize me, or you can belittle me, or you can demean me, or you can lie to me, but don't you dare do that to our children, because it's going to end there. And sure enough, that's often the shattering event when they realize their children are either experiencing abuse or seeing abuse, that they walk out. The third most common reason that people give for finally getting out of abuse is they pray about it. And they say, God, give me clarity. Just tell me what to do. I've tried. I've prayed. I've fasted. I've tried being more agreeable. I've tried being more sexually enthusiastic. I have done everything my church, my pastor, my women's director, and Focus on the Family told me to do 1,000 times. I mean, this isn't like I've tried 3 times or 6 times or 10 times or 20 times. I've literally tried 1,000 times, 2,000 times. I mean, for people who've been in a 20-year marriage, that's 7,000 days. So they come to the Lord and say, tell me what to do. I don't believe in divorce. I don't believe you're happy with divorce. Tell me what to do because I can't take it anymore. And believe it or not, God oftentimes tells them they can go. For some people, it might be a Bible verse. For other people, it might be a sign. For some people, it might be, God, tell me 1 year from today, tell me if I should leave. And God does. It is really amazing. And I'm not the kind of person who, feels like the Holy Spirit's always talking to me. But when you're praying that way, when you devoutly believe that God hates divorce, and yet you're asking God, nothing short of a sign from you will let me walk out that door. It might be a dream. It's often a dream in some cases. So, and that's a very biblical thing. God speaks to people in dreams all the time in scripture. The fourth most common reason that people get out, or shattering event that makes them leave, is that they simply can't take it anymore. They have depression, they have suicidal thoughts, or as we know, abuse really does a number on us both mentally and physically. So abuse does correlate with all kinds of autoimmune diseases and with all kinds of mental health issues. And some people, it sends them to the hospital. And I remember one man in my group, and I've interviewed him on my YouTube channel, who said, I had such suicidal thoughts. I was hospitalized, and for the first time in my life, I felt safe. I felt safe, and I felt I could finally look at my situation and not just, walk on eggshells and be afraid of my abusive wife. I could think through what my next step was. And I could think through the difference between what my church was telling me and what was actually happening. I could think through between my wife's false allegations and what was true. And so for many of these people, they get hospitalized and they feel safe for whatever the length of time is, for a week or 2 weeks or even 30 days. And they get professional treatment for the first time. And secular therapists are, not impressed by, Christians' lack of real research on these topics. And they come to the person and say, what's the truth that's going on in your life? And so a lot of people make the decision to leave after they've been hospitalized for suicide and things like that. The next one is, a friend walked with me and gave me courage. It's very interesting. A lot of us, in my case, I had a friend who was probably 30 or 40 years older than me. She was at church. We were in a woman's group together. And when I told her I was going through a divorce and I was breaking into tears every 5 seconds, she looked at me in the eye and she took my hand and she said, divorce is not the worst thing in the world. And she smiled and winked at me. You have no idea, or maybe, well, you probably
do. I do have, yes.
But people watching this may not have any idea of how powerful that is. Because here she was, a woman 30, 40 years older than me, who had raised her three daughters herself. And her three daughters were spectacular human beings. And my girlfriend, this woman friend, was a high-ranking financial officer in a major Christian organization. And I can't tell you how much hope that gave me. That was really wonderful. I'm going to go through the next five reasons people leave very quickly, and I won't go into much detail on them. Number six is someone I respected told me I was free to go. It might be a boss, it might be a doctor, it might be a pastor, and it might be an old friend from high school. Number seven was I could see the vicious anger in my spouse. I could read it in their face, and I knew that if I didn't escape with the clothes on my back and race out that door, I would be killed. And so I have a lot of people in my group who raced out that door and never returned. Number eight was my spouse divorced me or walked out on me. So you didn't even have a choice. There's unilateral no-fault divorce in most states in the United States. Number nine was an old friend told me I was worthy of love, not disrespect. This is really common with people who knew you in high school or in college and said, you know, I still see that you're valuable and worthy and that you're a wonderful person. And I can see you've been beaten down by your spouse, but that wonderful person is still deep there inside. And then last is the gray divorce. And number 10 is the kids have left the nest. It's the empty nest syndrome. And the woman or the man looks at the other person and realizes there's no longer children to act as a buffer in this home. There's no longer children to act as witnesses to any violence in this home. I am sleeping with the enemy. I am alone with a very dangerous person. And so those are the top 10 that I've seen.
Oh, I so appreciate that, Gretchen. I especially want to focus on the fifth one because you know, every survey that they do now comes up with the same statistic that one in four church members are in a destructive relationship. And it seems the church has known about abuse for over 30 years, and it's like it's not making much difference. There are some denominations that are, you know, we have the conferences, we have the workshops, we have this, that, and the other, but still, I think the members themselves either don't know how to approach it or it's too horrific an idea to think that a leader, especially a pastor or a devout deacon or an elder, would be abusing the spouse in the home. It's just beyond their comprehension. And so too much, I think, of the old ideas that it must be her fault operate within the church. And even for those who don't scorn and disdain the suffering spouse, they are so bewildered as to what might be helpful. They certainly don't want to expose themselves to a violent person. And I was just wondering if you see any of the churches or the church members becoming more informed about, like you said, it's taken you this long to learn. Are more churches communicating this idea that this is not just bad behavior? This is not, he just had a bad day. These minimization phrases are not helping people in the church understand this is an extreme danger. Right. It's destroying people. It's destroying children. And this is something that as the church, we have an obligation to extend compassion to someone who's being demoralized every day and having their faith, in the case of religious domestic abuse, having their faith used against them because the marriage itself is a legal and religious binding reality that makes it hard for people to leave. And so we are now reaching the conclusion that we're going to have to do something about the widespread collusion within the church, because women are leaving in droves.
Yeah.
And the women leave because they may go to a pastor who is absolutely clueless. The standard Bible prayer, these things about pray more, believe more, love more, these do not work in this situation, because you're dealing with an individual who is only using the faith in order to control the spouse, because the faith is important to the spouse. So do you see any progress or signs of hope that more pastors and more church members are at least showing an interest in learning what might be helpful? Like you said, that hand of that mother of the church. I mean, it's just so powerful.
And well,
what she did, she didn't, you know, turn her home out or anything. But this disdain or scorn or gossip, this condemnation or judgment that is put on women who are in suffering, I want church women to understand, I think they can turn it around. I think the women of the church do most of everything, and they can make this a place of compassion once again for women, especially who have been so downgraded and are being downgraded. So are you seeing any evidence to give you hope that more more pastors or members or church women are open to helping?
Well, I didn't expect to talk about it exactly, but you brought up something that really hit me hard, and that is that women can really do, even if the light hasn't turned on for the pastor, maybe he's well-meaning, but he's, you know, focused somewhere else, like on evangelism. The women in the church can really do a great deal. When little did my church really know, I went to a church that only allowed divorce for adultery and abandonment by an unbeliever. And we started this group. I've already told you that story. My girlfriend and I, we were both single moms, but we were both infidelity survivors, right? So we weren't abuse survivors per se. We had been cheated on. And so we started this group expecting everyone else to be someone who'd been cheated on, only to just be swamped with women who had been beaten, women who'd been slammed up against the wall, women who'd had knives thrown at them, women who had just been treated awfully. And so my co-leader and I looked at each other and said, what are we going to do now? Our church technically doesn't think that divorce is okay for a physical or emotional abuse, but these women are women of faith. They stayed in these horrible situations because they loved the Lord. What does this mean about God? What does this mean about our understanding of the Bible? And so we finally decided that God can't possibly be okay with emotional and physical abuse, especially when these women would tell us, you know, we are so grateful that you believe us, because no one believes anyone but you infidelity survivors. And it's so bad. We get so little compassion that some days we actually wish our husband would cheat on us. That would be, or leave bruises, for goodness sake, rather than belittling us, mocking us, giving us the silent treatment for 2 or 3 months, refusing to give us money to even pay for groceries. And so my co-founder and I agreed that this cannot possibly be good. This cannot be what a righteous, loving God would want. So we accepted everyone if they had a life-saving divorce, if they had a divorce for really serious reasons, then they were welcome in our group. Absolutely. Now, lo and behold, we never had anyone come to our group who got an I'm bored divorce, or I miss the party life divorce, or gee, I just feel unfulfilled divorce. Every single person who darkened our doors was somebody in tremendous problems. And so she and I just, we treated everyone the same. And it wasn't until later in my teaching and searching the scriptures that I realized that there really were Bible verses, Exodus 21, 10 through 11, and Deuteronomy 21, 10 through 14, that show that abuse and neglect genuinely are genuine grounds for divorce. In fact, God even commanded men who treated their wives badly, he commanded them to divorce them and let them go. Presumably so they could find someone who actually would treat them okay. Anyway, so I love your question. I do think that even if you're a woman in a church that technically believes in only none or one or two reasons for divorce, and none of those are abuse, I think you can still do a great single mothers group in your church and really offer a lot of hope. But then you went back and you asked me about pastors specifically. Do we have a minute for me to talk a little bit about, okay, thank you. Yeah. I think this is a really good question, because someone challenged me back in 2010 to read every book on the history of divorce that covers the past 3,000 years. And what I've discovered is that they were always churches and societies and leaders who cared about abused wives and were in favor of life-saving divorces. And there were also always, through the past 3,000 years, people who were the opposite, leaders who really didn't care about these victims and their children. They just wanted to stand for idealism rather than reality. Let me give you an example. The English reformers in the 1500s and the Puritans in the 1600s listed cruelty as one of their reasons for divorce. And the Bible in Exodus 21, 10 through 11 says that the neglect of provisions and the neglect of marital rights is grounds for divorce. I have a quote from an American patriot back in the 1700s, just after the Revolutionary War, who wrote an article on the tragedy of seeing abused wives commit suicide because they felt trapped in their violent relationships. And the man said it was a travesty. It doesn't honor God, and it makes God look cruel, and it would be better to let abused spouses out. And so I want everyone to know that the fact that we have churches that are compassionate and churches that are hard-hearted is nothing new. It's been going on for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I do want to be fair. I do think that most pastors go into the ministry to help people, not to hurt them. And I don't think that churches realize that they are siding with the abusers and betraying spousal abuse victims and their children when they pressure an abused wife or an abused husband to try harder, pray more, be more agreeable, be more sexually enthusiastic. These are little trite bits of advice that I'm sure this woman or man has done more than 1,000 times in their marriage. So when are we going to say to a woman or to a man, you've done enough. Now it's your husband's job to be mature, to be self-controlled, to be kind, committed, responsible, caring, for goodness sake, even to just obey the Ten Commandments. It's not your fault, and it's not your responsibility. Each of us stand before Jesus at the great throne of judgment in the end on our own. And we are asked about, our sins are all revealed at that time. So the pastor and the leaders may be very well-meaning, but they all only get their information from their friends and from, frankly, sources that are not known for their accuracy. Focus on the family and family life, who try to make divorcees out to be quitters who just took the easy way out, which is a claim on the Focus on the Family website or on the Family Life website. They actually have a claim that if you've been treated badly and you've been injured and you want to leave, then you're hard-hearted. You're the one deceived by the deceiver. And you just go, what kind of person could publish that? What kind of organization could possibly say that about abuse victims? These people stay for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Are you nuts? A 20-year marriage, that means over 7,000 times they've walked back into that house to face that mean or indifferent or vengeful or hate-filled person. Let me tell you, they are not the hard-hearted ones. They've proven to the world that they tried. But I don't want to be too hard on pastors and church leaders, because before my divorce, I too believed that divorcees were weak-willed people who just couldn't go the distance in marriage like the rest of us, or that divorcees selfishly put their own happiness ahead of their children. And they didn't care. They were just looking for the grass is greener, and they didn't care if divorce destroyed their kids. But that was before I got my own life-saving divorce. And I apologize to anyone back in the 1970s and 1980s who I might have judged. And I wanted to say something else. I am not a therapist, and I don't have any degrees in psychology or counseling. But as I said earlier, I have one advantage over counselors who are paid and pastors who have pastoral counseling is just one of many hats they wear. And that's that I've listened to literally thousands of stories from abuse victims. If you don't ever hear these stories from the lips of the people who are abuse victims, you really are taking someone else's word for it. Don't do that. Come to my website, come to the Life-Saving Divorce. I have lots of people's stories. I have YouTube videos telling stories. Listen to them. Develop some compassion. Soften your heart. Have ears to hear, because Jesus came to set the captives free and to set people free from the bondage of evil. And there are hardly few things than the evil that is done to an innocent spouse cowering in fear in their own home behind closed doors. So one of the things I no longer believe are some of the, what I call the five big lies in Christian marriage articles. The five big lies are that divorce is universally destructive to children. No, it's not. In 30 years of research show that divorce is likely the absolute best thing for children in high conflict, highly toxic homes. The next big lie is that divorce is universally destructive to adults. You'll never be happy again. You're going to be depressed, and that your next marriage will fail too. But the truth of the matter is that studies have been done on long-term, miserable, unhappy, let's just call them what they are, abusive or unfaithful marriages. And if you were in one of those long, miserable, unhappy marriages, guess what? Your next marriage is likely to be much happier. And I found in a straw poll I did in my life-saving divorce private Facebook group that 8 in 10 people said that their health improved after their separation of divorce. And in another straw poll, I asked, how do your children feel about you being divorced? Are your children, I have a lot of big homeschool families, like, you know, 5 to 12 kids. Okay, so I asked the question this way. Is at least one of your children really happy you got divorced? And more than 8 in 10 people who responded to this survey, and it's a straw poll, it's not a scientific survey, said, yes, I had at least one child who was happy, or at least felt the divorce was the best option in a horrible situation. 10 out of 100, or, you know, 1 in 10 said, well, I've never asked my kids. And then another almost 1 in 10 said, no, none of my children agree with my decision to divorce. So that's saying that the vast majority of children in these highly toxic, abusive homes are thrilled when their nurturing, loving parent finally gets to safety. Another big lie is that God hates divorce in every case. People who say that miss the fact that divorce is actually commanded 3 times in the Bible and only prohibited once. And we don't have time to go into it today, but if you'd like to see my evidence for that, people can go to lifesavingdivorce.com/abuse-in-Bible. And then the fifth big lie is that a good spouse can single-handedly fix a marriage and make it loving and safe. No, I'm sorry. You know, you can't. It doesn't matter how positive you are, how good an example you set. You cannot make a person who feels entitled to abuse, who feels entitled to cheat, who feels entitled to treat you any way they like, you're not going to be able to make that person change. And if that person has claimed to be a Christian all these years, let's say they're the elder or the pastor you mentioned earlier, then they've been reading the Bible. God's been calling them to righteousness for thousands of days. And the Holy Spirit has been convicting them of sin and righteousness for thousands of days. If God can't get through to them, how can a mere human being like you or me get through to them? God gives free will. God doesn't force people to follow him. We're not little robots. So I think that's, I want to free people who are in abusive situations, who've been told that if they just do more, that it'll change. No, you've already done more. You've done thousands of mores, and it hasn't changed your spouse.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Gretchen, because I came to that understanding myself, that it was really prideful of me to think that I could do what only the Holy Spirit can do. The person has to work with the Holy Spirit himself or herself. I just would like to thank you for your time. I would like to just put in here that I think the easy answer or the simple answer for anyone is to educate themselves. There's a ton of information out there. Your site and book, your group, my site, and it's just so, I'm so pleased that so many people are understanding that using God's name to abuse is still abuse, and it is not godly. And that I had a pastor tell me that they gave their church supported the shelter, and that was all they needed to do. And I'm just encouraging the pastors to educate their members that if part of the doctrine is that the woman must submit, then that encourages a batterer. And even people who aren't in the church, there are records of men or women quoting that verse to justify their mistreatment of their spouses. So if the least that a pastor could do is begin to educate the congregation and uphold the dignity and value of the woman as the same equal soul as the husband. Women are not second-class souls. Jesus was clear about the way he treated women, that he values them as well as men. So I think education and just adhere to the foundational teaching of compassion for the suffering. And love makes a way. Love will make a way for you to help the suffering member who is in a destructive relationship. So thank you so much for your expertise, your compassion, and your work, Gretchen, and I'm honored to be partnering with you in opening the door.
Well, I'm honored to be partnering with you too. I've interviewed you 3 times. My interviews with you are up on YouTube, and they are powerful. And in fact, I was going to stop at doing 2 interviews with you, and I had so many people say, how did Shirley, you know, make it after divorce? And so that's why I had to do the third interview with you. So yeah. And I want to just go back and say what you said, and that is imitate Christ. Look at how Christ dealt with women. He was always respectful. He met with them alone, and you know, he never chewed out any women in the Bible. He was pretty, harsh with the guys who got in his face, but even the women who talked back to him, Jesus always praised them in the end. So God, Jesus had a real soft spot in his heart for women.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Gretchen. Peace.
You're
and
very
blessings.
Welcome. Thank you.